That we're looking at a passage where Syria has come down to attack Israel. They have gathered around the city of Samaria. You can see here in the central hills of Ephraim. This is where Samaria is at. And that tells us that Samaria has basically taken over all this land. Some of this land was lost under previous kings of Israel. When some of the kings were wicked, God allowed them to be defeated by their enemies, and Syria captured some of this northern areas, like up here around Galilee, has already been taken. So the fact that they have pushed down into Samaria shouldn't be a surprise. It's not that much farther for them to have come. But let me zoom out so we can just get an idea of where things are at. Damascus, the capital of Syria, is here. Syria occupies much of this area up this way. The Hittite Empire went into what we call Turkey. In that time it was called Asia. But the Hittites stretched up into this northwestern region. Syria, here in the center of the map. And we want to make mention of something else that's going on, if we zoom out even farther, because you have this area here. Anybody know who resides in this area? That's where the Euphrates River is at. That's true. What's that? It is Iraq today. It wasn't then. Let me bring up a... Let me see if I can bring up another map that'll give you a name you'll probably recognize. You see this city right here? Nineveh. Yeah, Babylon was centered down here where the Tigris and Euphrates converge. This was sort of the center of the Babylonian Empire. But up here, just a little bit to the north and west of Babylon, is a country called Assyria. Don't confuse Syria and Assyria. So if it's just S-Y-R-I-A, you're talking about this just north of Israel, the capital of Damascus. Nineveh is the capital of Assyria. At this point in history, we know from studying some other aspects of history, it's not mentioned in the Bible just yet, but at this point in history, Assyria is under a couple of very strong kings who are beginning to expand the Assyrian Empire aggressively. And they're going to stop, and you're going to get about a century of respite from the Assyrians. But eventually, it's going to be the Assyrians who come down and conquer Syria and eventually destroy Samaria. So what's going on in the background while Ahab, the king of Israel, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, are duking it out? In their backyard, Nineveh and the Assyrians are beginning to grow in power and prominence. The Assyrians were lovable people. They liked to put knives on their chariot wheels so that as they drive by you, they don't have to bother shooting arrows at you. They can just dice you into pieces. And they had this fun habit of when they defeated you in army, taking the heads of all the warriors and piling them up at the city gates nearest where the battle took place. So you can see they were a lovely bunch of people. You might recognize the Assyrians and their city Nineveh from the biblical prophet Jonah. Jonah is going to take place in another 100 or so years. It's not going to be quite then. Actually, what happens somewhat is Jonah goes and preaches to Nineveh, and that preaching turns the country around for a little while, because I mentioned there's a little bit of a respite that Israel gets from Assyria while they're under some weaker kings. A lot of that is probably because of Jonah's preaching. It gave Israel some time as God was working amongst the nations there. But then Israel remained disobedient under ungodly kings, so that eventually in 722 BC, the Assyrians come down and they destroy Samaria. But that's another 100 or so, 150 or so years from where we're at now. We're looking in the, we're in the middle of the 900s BC right now with Ahab. It's going to be, it's 722, so actually a little more than 150 years before, before the Assyrians come down and my computer froze up. So that's the rough layout of things. Well, we'll just have to leave that where it's at. We're gonna have to pull the battery to get it to restart though. So, alright, so where we're at here in, chapter 20, we have to say previously on a series of kingly lessons. Anybody remember where we left off? What was going on? It wasn't Nebuchadnezzar. Some foreign king came and did something really bad, right? Yeah, so Samaria has been besieged by Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. So we left off the battle last time that Ahab is cooped up in his city of Samaria, and he's looking out over this massive troop of people besieging him. And I think, where did we leave off? It was somewhere, had we discussed the prophet telling Ahab to send out people yet? I don't think we had. I think where we left off was that Ahab rejected any offers of peace that Ben-Hadad sent in because they were completely out of hand. Ben-Hadad demanded permission to just take whatever he wanted, people or stuff. And so Ahab said no. And at that point, Ben-Hadad began getting his armies ready to be able to take the city. That's right. That's where we were. Verse 12, Ben-Hadad heard this message as he was drinking with the kings in his booths, and he said to his men, take your positions. And they took their positions against the city. That's where we left off last time. So Ahab can look on us from the city walls out on this huge, huge group of Syrian soldiers. And it was a coalition of Ben-Hadad and 32 other kings. So verse 13, behold, a prophet came near. What's his name? Kind of a trick question, isn't it? Because it doesn't really tell us, does it? Isn't that interesting? Just last chapter, Elijah was complaining to the Lord, I alone am left. And now who do we find here in the very next chapter? There's another prophet. This is where we talked about Ahab, or not Ahab, we talked about Elijah in his discouragement, believing the lies that he tells himself. He's not the only one. God's program doesn't get down that way. He reserved for himself 7,000 people in Israel that hadn't worshipped Baal. And so here's evidence of it. Here's another prophet, not Elijah. We're not sure where Elijah is at this point, or Elisha. But it's neither one of them, and it's some other prophet that God is using. Thus says the Lord, have you seen all this great multitude? And Ahab would say, I look at it every day. Have you seen this great multitude? Behold, I will give it into your hand this day, and you shall know that I am the Lord. So there's the statement. Now think about this. Why does God ask questions? To get us thinking. So what does he want Ahab to think about? When he says, "How have you seen this great multitude?"
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. God very often wants us to see how big the problem is before he'll provide a solution. Isn't that how it goes? You start praying about a situation and it seems to get worse. And before God brings in an answer, and that is just because God wants you to see how really bad it actually is, before he's going to step in and fix it. That's how he teaches us to trust him. And so he asks him this question, have you seen this great multitude? It's not just because he wants to know, have you looked out your window lately? It's because, Ahab, I want you to think about how big this army is. You have no hope of defeating this thing on your own, right? Right. So what's going to be the answer? And God gives him the answer. Behold, there's that word, tells you something out of the ordinary is going to happen. Behold, I will give it into your hand this day. Don't you wish God would answer your prayers like this day all the time? Usually he makes us wait long past when we thought the answer had to come. But he gives Ahab this promise. I'm going to defeat this army for you today. You're not even going to have to wait till tomorrow. All right, we're going to load our map here again, and hopefully this time we won't crash. There's our titles. Oops, I always hit that button thinking it's make the text bigger, but oh! Cancel that. Intermission, yeah. Just talk amongst yourselves. You know, I don't know why this program has so much trouble with this map. It's too big, yeah. All I did was tell you to load this one. There we go. All right, now this is the button that makes the text bigger. All right, so we're going to zoom back in a little bit from where we were so we can see what's going on. We are up here in Samaria. This is the city in the hill country of Ephraim where things are being besieged, right? And so the prophet comes near. Today I'm going to give it into your hand. At verse 14, Ahab asks this question, by whom? What do you think he means by that? How are you going to save us? Yeah, he might mean that. In what sense, though, of how are you going to save us? Who's going to save us? Why would he be asking who, though? He doesn't believe? So you think it's a challenge to God? Okay. Yeah, it could be. Yep, it could just be an admission. We don't have anybody, so who's going to do this? It could also, the other option is that he could be asking for instruction and saying, okay, who do you want to go out to battle that you're going to do this? Generally speaking, when God delivered an enemy into Israel's hands, he didn't do it in a overtly miraculous way. There were occasions, but many of the times Israel still had to go out and fight. And so it could be that Ahab is simply saying, okay, give me my marching orders by who? I think there might be a little bit of question there about, well, who's going to do this? We don't have any troops. We don't have hardly anybody left in this city. So, but he does ask the question, and God's going to answer this, because the next phrase says, thus says the Lord, by the servants of the governors of the districts. What do you think that means? All the people? Okay. He's going to number them for us here in just a few minutes, in fact, in verse 15. Let's read on here and we'll piece it all together then. Then he said, who shall begin the battle? And he answered, you. Then he mustered the servants of the governors of the districts, and they were 232. And after them, he mustered all the people of Israel, 7,000. So here's the marching orders that God gives. I'm going to save this city by defeating that huge army by the servants of the governors. So, if you remember under Solomon, Solomon had the whole country divided into districts. And there was a governor of each district, and he was responsible for taxation, public improvements, things like that. Just like we have governors of states, but they had districts. And so, the servants of the governors wouldn't be the total number of people, it would have been the household servants of those governors. So all the people that worked at the governor's mansion. God says, I'm going to save you by the hand of all the servants in the governor's mansion. 232 men. How many people out there in the Syrian army? Thousands upon thousands. It doesn't directly tell us. Later on in the chapter, we're going to read it's probably somewhere around 130,000 people. So 232 people God is going to use to save Israel from 130,000 people. Do your math real quick. That's what? Somewhere around 500 people per Israelite that you have to kill in order to defeat the army, right? So odds are not good that Israel's going to do this, but God likes to put himself in these positions where he can save by means that we would discount, that we would say it's not possible. We would say it can't be done. And God says, just watch me. I will do it. Okay? So Ahab then asks the next question, who will begin the battle? And he's told, you will. That's saying who's going to lead the troops out into battle. Oh, I'm sorry, not who's going to lead the troops, but should we wait for them to attack us? Or should we go out and sally out of our defenses and try and attack them on the open field? And so when God says, you do it, he's saying, Israel, you're going to go out and begin the battle. You're not going to stand here and wait for Syria to attack you. Go on the offensive. So what kind of tactical strategy is it for 232 people to attack 130,000? Not usually a good one. Usually a good, sound tactical strategy in that situation is retreat. Right? You are tactically unmatched. Get out of there and follow the old adage, he that fights and runs away lives to fight another day. Right. Bravely turn your tail and run. Well, God says, no, you're not going to do that. I want you to obey me and see what I'm going to do for you. So just like the Levites carrying the ark had to step into the Jordan River before God started drying up the waters, God is telling Ahab, these servants of the governors, they're not even soldiers. They're like the cupbearers, the janitors, the cooking staff. They're going to bravely wield their icing things. What do you, that really came out a lot less dramatic. Spatulas. Yeah. They're going to use their whisks and spatulas against this Syrian army and they're going to win. Not because they are mighty warriors, but because God is a mighty warrior. Because God rules in the affairs of men. Because God, rules in battle. That's the term behind the Lord of hosts. Lord Sabaoth, his name. It means the God who is the general of the armies, the God who marches with his armies and wins battles. And so 232 people, Ahab does muster everybody else, all the soldiers that are left in Samaria, and how many of them are there? 7,000 fighting men left in Samaria. That's not a good force against 130,000. So in all ways, we're seeing that if God doesn't intervene in this, this battle is over. Because here you take the last of what you do have. You're safe in your city. Somewhat. Safe. Air quotes. You're safe in your city with your 7,232 people. If you stay there, you might be able to defend yourself for a while because it's very easy for those 7,000 to stand on the walls and shoot arrows at invaders, knock their ladders down, stop them from breaching the wall. That's relatively easy. If I send out everything I've got into a battle in the open field, there is a very good chance they all get wiped out, and then who's left to protect the city? Nobody. How often does God tell you to put it all on the line? Almost every time. You put everything on the line. If you're going to trust me, it's got to be all in. There's no chance of holding anything back. If I don't come in and rescue you, you're done for. Don't hold anything back. And so this is what Ahab is doing. You got to admit, this takes a little bit of faith on Ahab's part, doesn't it? We're going to see that come to play later on. He's the most wicked king Israel ever has. And yet at the end of his life, when he's rebuked by one of the prophets, he repents. Isn't that good hope for wicked people like me? God forgives. Okay. So, he musters everybody. Verse 16, they went out at noon while Ben-Hadad was doing what? Drinking himself drunk. How seriously does he take this battle? He's not all in, heart and soul, into this battle, right? He's looking at this. He thinks that Israel is already done for, and so he's already celebrating the victory. They're already throwing the victory party. And at noon, we just talked this morning about how often do people get drunk at noon. Well, there's a few times. It does happen, right? What is that old song? It's 5 o'clock somewhere. At noon, he's drinking himself drunk because he's not taking this seriously. He thinks it's all wrapped up and done already. Him and the 32 kings who helped him. Verse 17, of the servants of the governors of the districts went out first. And Ben-Hadad sent out scouts, and they reported to him, men are coming out from Samaria. And he said, if they have come out for peace, take them alive. Or if they have come out for war, take them alive. How does this statement read to you? Yeah, he doesn't feel threatened by this at all, does he? Once again, you see, Ben-Hadad thinks he's got this whole thing all wrapped up. It's all done. It's just a matter of time before he defeats Samaria. So a force starts coming out of the city against him, and he doesn't even take it seriously enough to say, get the battle lines ready. He just says, take them alive. There's not even a chance that we're not going to take them, right? He doesn't even prepare for a battle. He just says, take them prisoner. Whether they're coming out for war or for peace. If they came out to surrender, take them alive and bring them here. If they came out to fight with us, that's fine. Just knock their weapons out of their hands and bring them here. They are not a threat to us. That's where his position is. So he's not taking things very seriously. The 232 servants come out of the city. Verse 19. So these went out of the city, the servants of the governors of the district, and the army that followed them. So the 232 go out first, just like God said. And then the 7,000 are coming out of the city. So now Samaria is emptying itself against the hordes of Syrians. Verse 20, here's the result of the battle. Each struck down his man. So that's that picture of you get into battle and your opponent just can't stand before you. So these 232 guys knock out their guy. And the 7,000 come behind them and they knock out their guy. How many Assyrians left? Still over 100,000, right? So you would think at this point, that's sustainable losses for a force that size. You'd think they would just surround them and finish them off, but they don't. Each struck down his man and the Syrians fled. Yeah, it might be, right? So the Syrians fled. God just fills their hearts with fear at the sight of these Israelites. They must have been fierce looking guys, right? They're really snarling good. But the Syrians they just break down and they run. Love the verse in Proverbs that says, the heart of man is like rivers of water in the hands of the Lord. He directs it wherever he wants. God is quite able to overwhelm men with their own sense of fear. And he does. And so here come these Israelites. They're charging at these guys. There's no reason in the world that the Syrians should be afraid of them. And yet they all panic and run away. The Syrians fled. Israel pursued them, but Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, escaped on a horse with horsemen. You really shouldn't ride while drunk, right? Yeah, don't ride. Don't drink and ride. Yeah. We'll just throw that little public service announcement in. But here he is. He's been drinking, but he jumps on this horse and he runs off. And the king of Israel went out and struck the horses and chariots and struck the Syrians with a great blow. So here they are. You've only got 7,000 guys. You're chasing this army. And just as they run, you just keep picking them off. 7,000 Israelites. And they're chasing 120-some thousand Syrians. And they're just leaving streams of them dead along the trail. Oh, yeah. After a few days, it would not smell good, would it? Mm-hmm. But notice what he does. What's he do with the horses? He kills the horses. Now, if you come up upon an enemy tank, wouldn't you maybe try to take it? Turn it against the bad guy? Why do you think he kills the chariots, the horses? Well, it could be. Maybe he's killing the horses out from under them. Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. So take the horse out, stops the chariot. Okay. So Ahab goes through and he wipes out this army. I mean, their entire ability to make war is being trampled on here by this small Israelite force. Verse 22. They're all back in Samaria, apparently. The prophet, that's the same guy that spoke to him earlier, the unnamed prophet, came near to the king of Israel and said to him, come, strengthen yourself and consider well what you have to do, for in the spring the king of Syria will come up against you. It's not over. Next year, come springtime, the king of Syria is going to remuster his army and he's going to be back. So what's Ahab got to do? Start getting ready. Rebuild the breaches in the walls, rebuild the towers, restock your army. Get Israel ready to defend itself. That is the responsibility of a king, isn't it? Isn't one of the most basic functions of government to protect its people from invasion, from outside threat, and from, you know, protect the laws of the country, enforce them? But that's why we place such an emphasis on the defense of our country. It's one of the most basic functions of a government. And so God's telling Ahab, do what I put you here to do. You're going to protect Israel, so start getting that army ready. You've got less than a year to do it. So your fighting force has been reduced to 7,000 men. How quickly can you replenish that in 9 months? Probably not too much. You might start encouraging family size somehow. Start giving more of a child tax credit. Say, look, we need soldiers. Let's go. Grow them. So obviously within the next year, you're going to have a few people come of age and ready to join the army. But who knows how many it would be. But there's the warning from the Lord to King Ahab. Next year, it's going to come. You better be ready for it. And the servants of the king of Syria, here's the fun part, verse 23. They all get back to Syria. And they're sitting in their halls wondering what in the world happened. How did we get defeated by such a small little out of the way force like Israel? I mean, we just really got whooped by them. And we don't understand what happened. Of course they don't understand what happened. It doesn't make any sense apart from God's mighty working, does it? But there's what happened. And so they're sitting around talking about it, debriefing themselves after the battle. And here's their answer. The servants of the king of Syria said to him, "Ah, their gods are gods of the hills, and so they were stronger than we. But let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they." How many of you find that a fun statement? Right? Why would they say something like that?
They have to explain it.
There's no reason we lost. Okay. They're making excuses, okay? You know what's a lot of fun? When we, several years ago, in the middle of the last century, we found a treasure trove of tablets in a place called Mari that confirmed everything the Bible tells us about the Canaanite religion. It was as corrupt and wicked as the Bible describes it. But it also enlightened for us what the ancient world thinks about their gods. We, who have a biblical conception of God, come to a statement like this and say, that's nonsense. God's limited to certain terrains. But you know what? It wasn't that uncommon. The conception in the mind of most ancient Near Eastern people was that your God was pretty much limited to the country that worshipped him. So the territories of the country roughly defined the power territory of your God. If he wanted to get stronger, he needed more people worshiping him in different places. And so battles between armies were frequently seen as a battle between one nation's god and another. And whichever nation's god prevailed was the stronger god. So it's not crazy. We think it's nuts because it's such an unbiblical view of who God really is. But if you put yourself in their position, say, oh, that's actually how they did think. They really aren't making up excuses. They really believe this stuff. You say, oh, that's why he won. Because Jehovah is a God of the hills. That's why they built Samaria up there in those mountains. But you know how we'll win? Get him out in the open plain land and then we'll be able to take him because he'll have no power there. So how well does it go when you tell God, you can't do that. You have no power there. God's going to save Samaria again in the next part of the chapter. And it's not going to be because of the faithfulness of Ahab. It's not going to be because of the faithfulness of his people. It's going to be simply because God says, I'm not going to let them say that and get away with it. I'm going to display my power and my glory so that both Syria and Israel know that I am God because they made this statement. Something similar happens later on when Jerusalem is besieged by the Assyrians. And this commander comes to the walls of Jerusalem and shouts out to Hezekiah, and everybody's standing on the walls, and says, I'm going to come in, I'm going to destroy your city because my God is stronger than your God. And don't you think that anything is going to be able to stop me? Have any of the gods of the nations yet been able to stop the mighty Assyrians? No, up to that point nobody has, but his insinuation is, my God is stronger than your God, and so don't think to yourselves that our God will save us. And Ahab takes that letter, and he lays it out, not Ahab, I'm sorry, Hezekiah takes that letter, and he lays it out in the temple and says, God, you can read this, you know what the man's saying, save us. And God says, yeah, I'm not going to let him say those things about me and get away with that. And 185 Assyrians die that night because God says, I will not share my glory with another. I'm getting into next week's sermon, by the way. But here's the setup for it. Here's the plan. Okay, Jehovah must be a God of the hills. He's limited to that region. That's why they built Samaria in the hills. So if we can draw Ahab into an open battle on the plains, then we'll be able to beat him. So here's the plan. Verse 24. Do this. Remove the kings, each from his post, and put commanders in their places. Obviously, the kings that you brought with you last time weren't serious about the fight. They're just carousing and drinking all day. So let's put some commanders in their place that know how to fight a battle, and maybe that'll do better for us. Secondly, muster an army like the army that you have lost, horse for horse and chariot for chariot. And then we will fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And he listened to their voice and did so. Here's part of where we draw together how large the Syrian force was, because they put together a force that's the same size as the one they just lost. And later in the chapter, it describes it in verse 29 and 30 as being about 127,000 people. So that's how we know roughly 130,000 people coming at this first sieging of Samaria. But there's the setup. We're not done. We're going to go back and try this one more time because we really think that our God, Hadad, the God of the Syrians, has got to be stronger than Jehovah. Because after all, look how small Israel is. They're just this puny little country right now, so their God must not be very strong. And God's going to correct their thinking on this, just like God often does. God works all things after the counsel of his own will, right? So does the apparent size of the matter determine how strong he is? Not in the slightest. Why was Israel small and weak at this point? Was it because Jehovah was weak? It's because his people weren't being faithful to what he called them to do, and he was disciplining them. And he was allowing the nations of the world to think of him in small ways so that he could discipline his people Israel. So, how does our life reflect the glory of God? Do we act like God is big, or do we act like he's small and limited? Tough question, huh? We'll continue on with the rest of the battle next time. Actually, tonight I was supposed to get into my glory I will not give to another and the rest of the battle, but we'll do that next week. Any questions? Comments?